Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
What's up? Welcome to episode 85 of Comic Book Nation, the official podcast of comicbook.com. I am your host, Kofi Outlaw, and with me today, my co-host, Matthew Aguilar.
What up?
And back with us is Mr. Connor Casey.
I'm back.
And over in the cut chair over there is Mr. Charlie Ridgely.
Hello.
So, we've gotten this fine collection of gentlemen here today, plus, I'm not going to insult anybody. I could say plus whoever I wanted to name there, but let's just keep it friendly. We brought all these fine gentlemen here today because we have a variety of things to discuss, and we need a variety of expertise to discuss it. So, we have a new WWE event coming up, Survivor Series, and Matt and Connor are going to break that down for us. We have some new comics to review, Marvel's Marauders and the ending of the Absolute Carnage event series. We have a new horror trailer that kind of caught my eye and I would love to discuss. Plus, DC Universe is basically given up, and we're going to talk about all of that. But first, the big thing, as you saw from the title of this episode, the big movie release of the week is Frozen 2, the long-awaited sequel to Frozen. And Mr. Charlie Ridgely went out and saw that, and I thought we'd kick off this episode by, I like to try to spread some of the big events around, so we give some in the beginning, some in the end. And I thought this would be a good time to have Mr. Charlie Ridgely come on and kind of drop his thoughts about Frozen 2. Because there's been a lot of hype, a lot of wait. But Charlie, you and Matt are probably our biggest Disney experts here working in the office. So what did you think of Frozen 2?
I'm going to be honest, I didn't love Frozen 2, which is really disappointing because I love the first Frozen. I really, really like the first Frozen movie. It's one of the better Disney films from, you know, since the 90s. I really, really enjoy the first Frozen. The second one, I think, left a lot to be desired for me. Part of it's, I mean, the hype, there's no way you can stand up to that first movie. And honestly, the biggest problem for me with the sequel was that it tried so hard to mimic the first movie. You know, when Frozen 2 was just being itself and allowing itself to be something different, it actually worked really well, but it spent its first hour or so really trying to just be Frozen again. You know, the songs really kind of felt off, and they didn't really, like, the story didn't really flow into the songs. It just kind of like, oh, now we're going to sing because we want, this is the moment when it happened in the first one, and it's a similar kind of song. And, you know, they tried to make Anna and Elsa exactly the same, you know, and make their relationship the same in the beginning. And it was all just really clunky. Like, the story got off to a weird start and then just really accelerated, and there wasn't any explanation. There wasn't any, you know, time to figure out what's happening. It just all of a sudden, this new grand big thing is going on, and they go into this adventure into the Enchanted Forest. It all feels very off. I really struggle with the first hour or so of this movie, but the back half, I think, really redeemed it and made it, you know, made it pretty good overall. The final hour or so really let itself be different. And that's when you have, like, it's a darker movie. It's a more adventurous movie. The songs are a little more out there. Like, they're very unique from the first one. There's a very specific point where a character has a song, and from that point on, the whole thing kind of changes, and the finale works pretty well, even though the twists are kind of telegraphed. Like, as an adult, you know, you figure out pretty early on what's going on, but how they get there is enjoyable once you get to that second half of the movie. The first half really, really did not sit well with me. So overall, it was fine.
That's so weird too, because, like, in the trailers, and one of the things we all talked about when those trailers hit was how different they looked. So were the trailers, like, all from the second half? I mean, or is it just the way they're laid out?
A lot of those stuff in the trailers is from the middle of the movie.
Okay.
So it's kind of a mix of the two. And I mean, like, the locations are different almost from the beginning. But they went to this new place and it felt like they were still trying to be, you know, what it was in the first movie. And so like while they're in the woods and meeting these characters and trying to do new things, they're not really taking any leaps. They're not really taking any chances. It's not, you know, kind of the theme of my review when I wrote it up was the whole anthem of this movie is supposed to be Into the Unknown. That's the name of the song. That's like the Let It Go of the second movie. And it takes forever for the filmmakers to actually be willing to do that. Be willing to go into something that they don't know and something new and exciting. It's like they were kind of afraid early on. They were afraid it wasn't going to work. And they wanted to make sure that this was as good as the first one. And I think in doing that kind of lost themselves a bit.
So do you say that Disney Animation doesn't quite yet have some of the flexibility and freedom that like Pixar would have with making a sequel?
I don't know if it's a flexibility thing, because like one thing I found weird.
Just asking because you just phrased it. You said it seems like that they weren't sure it would work.
Right. And I think that was just from a specific filmmaker standpoint. Because I mean, the co-director of this movie and the writer of this movie is Jennifer Lee, who runs Disney Animation Studios. So I think it was, you know, anyway, it didn't feel like a yes. situation, like an extreme example, but with Suicide Squad, where there's clearly an executive influence on a movie, it didn't feel like there was any trepidation.
Let me rephrase. Do you feel like whether the pressure was from the studio or just from the filmmaker themselves, you know, filmmakers themselves, do you feel like they're the pressure to create another massive Disney successful product?
I think part of it is just because Disney doesn't make that many sequels. When they do, it's such a big ordeal. Any Disney film you kind of go back and look at over history, any of the really popular ones, the only sequels they really got were like straight to DVD, you know, things. And some of them, like I love Aladdin King of Thieves. Like that's a really fun movie to me, but like it's a straight to DVD sequel.
And also
it's
the
fun.
Sequel, the direct
Return
sequel
of Jafar
sucked.
Is bad.
Yeah, so and Lion King got a sequel.
I kind of liked Return of Jafar.
As a kid, I liked it.
Lion King 2 was eh.
But
was
like, you're right, though. Little Mermaid, like all those direct to DVD
these
sequels.
Chances. And when you look at kind of the theatrical sequels, one of the only ones is Wreck-It Ralph. And I think Ralph Breaks the Internet is actually very good. But the first Wreck-It Ralph, while people loved it, it was not the phenomenon that Frozen was. And Frozen has such, like, I think there's such a pressure, like you say, Kobe, to live up to what Frozen was because of how big of a deal it became over the years. And I think that did get them flustered a little bit and worried. But once they kind of let go of that and let it loose, and Jennifer Lee had a really, really good idea and a really good story. The journey of these characters in this movie, where they ultimately go, is very worthwhile and really has an impact. Once they get to that point and really go into that journey, it works. It works very well.
Do you think female viewers will have it resonate as strongly as the first film did?
To an extent. Because at the core of it,
like, does it still tell like in some ways a very female centric?
Yeah, it's a very empowering story, and it's really at the core of it. It's about sisterhood again, and that's weirdly when they were trying to recreate that sisterhood in the beginning of the movie, it did not work. But once they kind of got away from it and just let it grow, that theme and the bond of Anna and Elsa got so much more impactful, and it really became more realistic. Once they journeyed out from what they were comfortable with, at the end of the day, it was still very much about how much they care for each other and how much they mean to each other. And kind of in addition to the sisterhood, this really dealt with a lot of family stuff. You know, we've seen from the trailers, a lot of it is about the history of their family. And so there's a lot of that at play. And instead of just sisters looking out for each other, it's kind of how they would have functioned in their family and what their family or how their family has affected them over the years. You know, like kind of the decisions of your father and mother and the impact that has on you. Kind of like the sins of the father type of thing. Just the expression, the sins of your father and how you're affected by that.
Right. Two questions to wrap it up. One, do you think Matt Aguilar will like this?
Matt Aguilar will give it a 6 out of 5.
Because
Olaf is in it. So,
I mean, he's
not well, the man knows. Tails. The man knows.
Well, there's Olaf, and then there's an even cuter sidekick in the little salamander that was in the trailer.
Okay, so Matt sold.
Oh,
we got
my
that.
God.
Now, final
Do Snow
question.
G's come back?
Do what?
Do Snow G's come back?
I do not want to say anything to you about it.
Right, okay, let Matt enjoy. Yeah.
I'm very excited.
I'm sure he'll come back and give us his thoughts when he goes to see this one. Final question. You have two highly anticipated movies this year. You've kind of not been really kind of enthused about either. Hmm. How would you rank this compared to Joker? I know they're two completely separate movies.
They are completely separate movies. Yeah. I like this a lot better because this one, to me, it almost redeemed itself. Like, I gave it a 3 out of 5 in my review, which is still more positive than negative, where I had a lot of issues with it. Part of it was I was so excited for this movie and it did disappoint me. But the back half is strong enough that it almost redeems some of the missing qualities of the front. So like when you leave a theater, you still feel somewhat fulfilled from this movie
because is there a song you're still singing?
It ends on a good note.
Is there a song you're still singing?
I don't. None of them are nearly as catchy as Let It Go.
Does Into the Unknown? Magic is you dead. Said that that's the Let It Go of
yeah.
This one. Do you think that blows up like Let It Go?
No, did? Not at all.
Okay.
Not all right. All.
There is one. I don't want to spoil what it is. There's one of them in the movie that it's that song I was talking about. Like at that point, it's right the middle of the movie, and at that point, I feel like the movie kind of changes and grows. But there's one song that it is filmed like an old music video, and they're very aware of the joke they're making, and it is so incredibly funny. And I really like, I could watch, I want them to release that video because listening to the song is fine, but watching it was so much more enjoyable. And I really want to watch.
I'm so excited
that happened again.
All right. That'll do it for Frozen 2. If you want to talk with Mr. Charlie Ridgely about this, you can find him. Where are you at, Charlie?
At Charlie Ridgely on Twitter.
Okay. So, and you can hit us up with the hashtag ComicBookNation and let us know your thoughts about Frozen 2 as well. Thank you, Charlie. Moving right along, we're going to go from the animated niceness of Frozen into the deep horrors of slavery because of a new trailer for a film from the producers of Jordan Peele's Get Out and Jordan Peele's Us. This new film is called Antebellum, which is a reference not to Lady Antebellum, sorry, but to rather the, whether or now I got to really question that band name. we're going to have a conversation about that later.
Oh my
but,
God, yeah.
the Antebellum South, which was, of course, the 18th century period between 1800 and 1900 in the American South when plantation system was in full swing and slavery was in full swing before 1861 in the Civil War and the New World that came after that during Reconstruction. So this movie is called Antebellum, which is, again, it's not by Jordan Peele. It is by two different directors whose names I still have up here, thank God, is Gerard Bush and Christopher Renz, who have done mostly music video work. They did Kill Jay-Z, that whole 2017 kind of short film called Kill Jay-Z. Mm-hmm. Which is about Jay-Z once again shedding his persona for like the 15th time, I guess. Anyway, they're making this film and it stars Janelle Monáe. And the premise is that she plays an author who's a very successful kind of black woman mother author. She's living in the South. She has like a very affluent, you know, lifestyle and group of friends that, you know, mixed race friends, all that stuff. She has a good life. But there is something that happens and we don't know. It's a supernatural thing where either aspects of like slavery, you know, past come appearing to her like flatliners, or she's, does the synopsis suggest she's getting sucked back into this time period and kind of being trapped in there and like waking up in this time period. And then it's the kind of comparison horror between, you know, America of today and America back then and how horrific it would be to live and maybe why it's not so different. Or as I noted in the trailer article, you know, metaphors about how certain aspects of that history are having a resurgence or how the traumas of that have never really kind of been healed and blah, 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 blah. So it looks like it could be a very kind of, if it's pulled off well, mm-hmm. and the imagery in the trailer is pretty gorgeous. I mean,
it's a great trailer.
Yeah, like, it's shot really well, and it's very haunting and kind of doesn't tell you anything. It's just very music, imagery, and very haunting, kind of the splicing between scenes in modern day America and these kind of plantation scenes and things and like supernatural little girls and body contorting and all of this crazy that stuff that's like happening in this movie. Looks like this could be definitely like the next Get Out type of thing that is a horror movie, but also sparks all this social discourse. And yeah, I was kind of surprised by this today. I wasn't expecting this one, and now I'm very interested.
So you said it has two different directors. It's not Jordan Peele, but is it like executive producing? Like
he said it's EP.
Is it? Yeah.
Yeah, I think he's listed as an EP. Okay. I will confirm for you in one second.
It definitely has that feel. I mean,
they're kind of sectioning out this lane of horror that's never been officially named now, but this kind of like race horror mixture and taking kind of like issues of social race or even like sexism, racism, things like that, and combining them into metaphors for horror stories. Yeah. It's something we're getting with just, you know, the natural increasing diversity in directorship and voices. Mm-hmm. Just like The Babadook was another great one about motherhood and stuff like that from a female director. So
Freaky Kid.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah, that was the scariest thing about that movie, right? But like, yeah, so we're having this kind of, you know, Hollywood's changing. People are kind of expanding. But it doesn't say Jordan Peele's officially producing this, but I think it's like Alex G. Scott.
I mean, Janelle Monáe, I just saw her in Harriet, and she was fantastic in that movie. I actually really like the movie in general. But yeah, I mean, I will watch her in anything. I think she's great on screen, and she seems to be the one who's going to carry this movie. So it's going to kind of, like we talked about Elizabeth Moss with Invisible, like it's going to be on her shoulders to really carry this, because there don't seem to be a ton of other prominent characters yet.
No, I mean, Jenna Malone and like Gabourey Sidibe are the two other biggest names. Jenna Malone, we know for like The Hunger Games, Sucker Punch, stuff like that. That cut scene of Batman and Superman.
Gabourey
Sidibe, who of course is Precious and has been in everything since then.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, this is going to be, looks like it's squarely on Janelle Monáe's. So. And I mean, she's a fantastic performer in pretty much everything. She can act. She does awesome music. She makes entire concept videos with her and Tessa Thompson that like
she's awesome.
Make you want to like get a better life and be like, I need to up my life.
I'm in all this. I
so like, yeah, I want to see this now. And I just want to see how they handle this completely dynamite stick subject matter and what the discourse is. I'm going to be just having my popcorn for the Twitter feeds around.
The conversation's going to be completely civil, I'm sure.
Oh, yes. This is going to be so nice.
I think it will be.
So nice.
Surprise us, internet.
Well, we told Charlie we're just going to throw him in a hole. But Charlie, what do you think about this?
About what?
Antebellum.
Okay, I was trying not to jump in.
Because no, I know. We threw you in a hole, but I just gave you a surprise pass.
It's very telling that they went with the Get Out and Us angle, you know, from the beginning.
Like right at the beginning
of the trailer. It's very, very much a social commentary, even though, like, it wasn't like a Jason Blum connection. It wasn't a Jordan Peele connection, you know. It's still a producer and it's important, but it was very much like, we want you to know, like, this is going to be a very socially awakening type of movie, or that's at least our goal in it. And I mean, Janelle Monáe and everything she's done from an acting perspective has been fantastic. And to date, she really only ever gets smaller roles. You know, I mean, which makes sense. She's really busy. Like, she has a great music career. But I'm really excited to see her kind of anchor this whole movie. And I mean, because she was part of a really great ensemble in Hidden Figures, and she was a fairly main character in that movie. This is hers. Like, almost more than the story, which looks really interesting. I'm more excited to see, like, what she does with an entire film on her back.
All right, that's it from the Charlie corner. Back over here. So, thank you, Charlie. We're going to move on because we're going to go from horror to some horrific things happening over at DC. So, we've had this DC Universe streaming service which tried to be the first out of the gate, proving again that being first can ultimately leave you last.
Oh man, can we call DC Universe the Dreamcast of streaming networks?
Yes, we can now.
Right? Because they were first out of the gate.
DC Dreamcast.
The Dreamcast of streaming services.
It was all there.
Netflix doesn't count because it started as a mail order disc thing.
It was online Blockbuster.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, DC Universe tried to get out there first and get out there like big streaming service. Then it has been crashing and burning ever since. Thankfully, Doom Patrol's coming back. Thankfully, Titans is coming back. Thankfully, we got HBO Max to hopefully give this whole thing a boost. But if you wanted a sign that DC Universe has truly given up, after the Swamp Thing debacle, there was another series that was supposed to set to debut this year. Well, Harley Quinn's coming in that. Could maybe save a lot of things. But there was going to be a Stargirl series that was coming. And now we're getting it, but there's a twist. So now DC Universe is giving up its exclusivity, quote air quotes, if you can't see me right now, but
so
I
weird.
Kind of, they'll launch new episodes of Stargirl on DC Universe to try to make those people watch it, and then they're going to put them on the CW the next day.
That's the part that's so weird. Like, oh my God.
No, it's not. It's acknowledging we're making good series that DC fans would love, but no DC fans can see them. So it sounds like Stargirl, and I mean, it makes sense. It sounds like Stargirl might be like one DC property that actually won't be like so R-rated that it can't be on the CW.
Yeah.
I mean, Doom Patrol could never be on the CW.
No.
And Titans has even just started throwing in random curse words and nude scenes like all over season two, plus some pretty brutal violence. So like you can't show that either. But it sounds like Stargirl, which is like more Geoff Johns-y and kind of thing, will be able to be kind of have some of the edge of the DC universe, but still make it onto a network. And this is just kind of a way
day thing. I get that because that makes total sense. Yes, I think it's a perfect fit.
Yeah,
for the CW side of thing. I just don't get like why do it at all. Like why just not give it to CW? Let them build
because
on that.
They gotta still. It's business. It's corporate business. You gotta keep the lie up until it just falls completely apart. So DC Universe is great until the day that it's just gone, and then like that's how I feel like they're gonna play this. And so they're just trying to, and I mean, they're not, I mean, I can't call it at this point. I'm not in the boardroom, but I don't think, I think they want to start attracting a wider audience to that content now so that next year when we get rid of DC Universe or just gets ported into HBO Max, then there will be even more actual incentive. Like nobody, I don't think anybody's dreaming that putting Stargirl on CW is going to get people into DC Plus or DC Universe.
Yeah.
That ship sailed, like way gone, like so far in the distance, and we see it sinking already, like from the shore. So I think they're just trying to, like I said, get people into the franchise, into the content, so that when they actually have a chance to do this again on HBO Max, more people will be aware, and they could also, it could be a good test subject for how they can use HBO Max and still pull things off of there and maybe do this whole cross.
Well, then they can actually use it as a... an incentive, selling incentive, and say, hey, look, all your favorite shows that were on that thing that you barely watched are now on a platform
that you will actually see them on and
you already have.
And you can watch Game of Thrones, Targaryens, and Stargirl, and Titans Season 3.
Stargirl is curious to me, because that was one of the early ones.
It actually doesn't sound so
bad. That was one of the early ones revealed and talked about. And we even got a promo image, like, really early, and then nothing.
Well, because I'm sure, like, after Swamp Thing, I mean, this whole thing about budgets and returns, and how do you even fund these shows? Oh, let's check the coifers on DC Universe. Hey, what is that? Is that lint? Oh, yeah. Like, how are we going to pay for this?
Yeah. And then Titans gets renewed for a third season. And you're like, I don't, like, okay.
I understand that, because Titans, as far as branding, and if you're building like an actual streaming service, the key that we always forget about streaming services, it's sometimes good to build up library for binging. And Titans will be the first show they actually have that is like a binging block that people will come out the other side of and actually have a quite possibly positive reaction to.
And don't get me wrong, I like Titans.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's just this, it's so scattershot sometimes that it just feels, it really does feel like they're kind of playing this fast and loose right now.
They obviously were from the moment they launched DC Universe, one of the most ill-conceived, not even streaming services, but just websites I've ever seen in the last 5 years.
Yeah.
Like, I just want to quit the service every time I have to go to Titans and figure out where, because it always takes you back. It always presents the season one episodes as the homepage. And I'm like, okay, that's not what I want. Like, obviously no one uses your service. Otherwise, you'd have season two because people would be continuing. And then I have to go all the way back up to the top of the page, the right-hand corner, to find the drop-down menu to get to season two.
Is there even an app for consoles yet?
I don't think there's one. I know
for
it's
PS4.
On Fire Stick. It did come on Fire Stick.
It's also on Roku.
Yeah,
it's on
it finally kind of went on there.
But it's not on Xbox or PS4.
Not that I know
I couldn't tell you.
Disney Plus has one opening day. It's like,
because Disney Plus likes viewers. The DC Universe was just like, we're so cool. We don't need that.
Yeah, Disney Plus definitely took notes and said, you did this wrong and this wrong and this wrong. Let's fix that.
Yeah, Bob Iger was like, here, welcome to our meeting. Here's how we're not going to be.
Welcome to DC Plus.
Yeah. All right, so Stargirl is coming to the CW. DC Universe is basically like dead. RIP DC Universe.
I'm glad it's still coming out. Yeah.
Yeah.
How soon before the Snyder cuts on HBO Max?
I mean, it could be announced tomorrow.
That countdown is on.
Yeah. It could be announced tomorrow. And if it's announced tomorrow, I mean, just know that I tell the future a lot. But
it'll still be bad.
Not touching that. We did that grenade last time.
Mini grenade.
We did that last show. I'm not getting it. All right. So don't let Connor throw you. Stay tuned, because when we come back, we're going to deep dive into a movie review and some comic reviews. And Connor and Matt are going to tell us all about what we should be looking forward to at WWE Survivor Series that's coming up this weekend.
Is your child struggling with a specific subject or need help with homework? Are they asking questions that you're not sure you can fully answer? IXL Learning is an online learning program for kids. It covers math, language arts, science, and social studies. IXL is designed. This program will improve your kids' grades. Studies done in almost every state in the country, the kids who had IXL are consistently doing better. Powered by advanced algorithms, IXL gives the right help to each kid no matter the age or personality. And it doesn't have to eat up all your time. One subscription gets you everything for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. So don't miss out. 1 in 4 students in the U.S. are learning with IXL. IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning Get IXL now. And listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/audio. Visit IXL.com/audio to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
All right, now that he's gone. No, I'm just kidding. Charlie Ridley's a good guy. You know, we get stuff because we get into it, but he's a good guy. So we're back now, and now it's time for my movie review. There's another movie coming out this week, which is 21 Bridges, starring my man Chadwick Boseman of Black Panther, James Brown, and oh my God, how am I messing his name? Jesse, oh man, oh my God. They're going to take away my black card after this. Sit down, Rich.
Jackie Robinson.
Thank you, Rich. Richard stood up in the booth and was like, this is your membership right here. This is your membership in the Black Club right here. Well, I remembered, Richard. Thank you, Jackie Robinson. Oh, man, yeah.
I wish we had a video of that. Anyway.
Dude, can you blame me? Chadwick Boseman's playing like every flameless black guy in existence.
Were you thinking of Jesse Owens?
Yes, I was. I kept thinking of Jesse Owens, and I was like, that's not it. Jesse Owens isn't it. But he's just not played Jesse Owens yet.
Yes.
And I guarantee, a month from now when we get out of here, I just saw the future again, and Chadwick Boseman will be announced as Jesse Owens. And I'll be like, well, there you go. But no, so he's played James Brown, Jackie Robinson, T'Challa. And now we got him playing an actual fictional character in 21 Bridges. He basically plays a cop who is, you get this whole backstory for him in the beginning. It's an effective beginning that explains who this guy is and why he's such an intense cop. He comes from a thing, a long line. His name's Andre, from a long line of cops. And it has to do with his dad, who was a cop. But he's basically known around the various precincts as the killer. Like, he's the dude who, his first scene is like, you know, he's had like 7 shootings in 8 years, all of them clean, all of them like high danger criminals, but he's just that dude in the department. So he gets pulled out one night when these two guys kind of go on this robbery for cocaine, and it goes sideways. They end up just having a major firefight with a bunch of cops. A lot of cops get killed, and, you know, the department's out for blood, and they call him in because he's got basically they get out of Brooklyn into Manhattan, and he locks down Manhattan. The FBI will keep it up for him from like 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. Simple movie, single night movie, action movie. And so he has to kind of hunt through Manhattan between hours of 1 and 5 and try to catch these guys. The end. So basically, 21 Bridges is a 90s movie that somebody dusted off and decided to make now. It is very much like every 90s action movie cliche, from the predictable plot twists and betrayals to just the way kind of scenes are executed, and this whole idea of kind of this guy going up against like high velocity automatic weapons, and only thing that his character ever picks up is his little tiny, almost ridiculous, like funny tiny Glock 9 that he's like just whipping around and stuff. What kind of distinguish it as at least being a very kind of fun B action movie, kind of crime thriller, are the cast, really. Chadwick Boseman is just like the man. I mean, the guy just has all-star charisma, and his version of this cop, Andre guy, he kind of nails somewhere between like an edgier Denzel, where he kind of like is more of a badass. Like, when he looks at another cop, it's like, I will beat, like, you know, the crap out of you. Like, you believe in.
Yeah. So he's a young Equalizer.
Yeah. But he's like very also smart, sharp, and kind of just has that kind of, you feel like you're looking at King T'Challa still. Like, he's very dignified, but edgy, kind of street at the same time. And that's very good in this kind of New York crime, hard-boiled crime thriller. The action and violence is very visceral in this movie. Like I said, this is 90s, like, where people didn't care about this. Like, where we pretend like mass shootings aren't like an extreme social trauma right now. Like, yeah, cops get laid out. People get their heads blown off in 2 seconds. Like, they're not shy about the blood splatter in this one, director Brian Kirk. But it's very satisfying in that visceral sense. And so the performances and the characters really make it. Boseman's great. The other cast members are Sienna Miller plays like this kind of grizzled narcotics detective that he gets partnered with. J.K. Simmons is the captain of the department where he like works for, that kind of is the one who brings him in and says, I want you to just kill these guys. Like, you know, my officers are dead. I'm not looking for arrests.
And then he says, I want pictures of Spider-Man.
Yeah, exactly. Like, so, I mean, he is basically J. Jonah Jameson with a badge.
Nice.
Stephon James and Taylor Kitsch are the two kind of the crook guys who get like wrapped up in this. And Taylor Kitsch is like really intense. I mean, he's the most scary person in the movie because they're because they're both ex-arm, like, Marines, and Taylor Kitsch is, like, the real crazy one who, like, came home and was never right. And, like, yeah, he's the guy who's, like, all about just going at it with the automatic weapons that are, and he's really good in this. So, and it's good to see him back. And there's also just, like, even the just the random people are famous, like, Keith David shows up, Morocco Omari shows up, some other people. But faces you've seen, or I'm not Marco Mamari, Alexander Siddig shows up as like a kind of fence guy in the middle of the film. Like, he's the guy who, you know, the criminals all funnel their money through and stuff like that. And so there's a lot of talent in this, in the cast, and that kind of redeems what is kind of just like a bare knuckle 90s crime thriller plot. Otherwise, like I said, you've seen this movie like 20 times before.
But you don't seem bummed about that.
No, I enjoyed it because Brian Kirk's direction is pretty good, and it's hard not to enjoy it as one of those movies. As you know, I give it about a 3 stars, because if you're just going to look for like just a simple satisfying action movie with a good lead, classic Hollywood style, this delivers that. It's nothing revolutionary. It's nothing like John Wick-ish. It's just, like I said, it's 90s shootouts, running after people, car chases, stuff like that. Nobody's doing kung fu in the hallways and stuff like that. You know what I mean? So it just satisfies on that level. Like, you watch it, you're like, okay, that's great. It'd be a fantastic matinee. Like,
okay.
Or just a good like night out if you and your spouse love action movies or love Chadwick Boseman. All, any of those are suitable for you to buy a ticket for this.
Okay.
So 21 Bridges, good little crime, suitable little crime thriller. All right, that's it for me. Let's move on and talk about Marvel. We're tracking this X-Men Dawn of X relaunch, but we're going to do a little X-Men and a little Spider-Man today. We'll real quick just go through Excalibur and Marauders. I don't have too much to say about Excalibur. It was all right, the second issue.
Okay, so here's my biggest thing, because I don't really have that much to say about it either. Better or worse than the first issue?
A little bit better.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so a little bit better, because the first issue just had to go into, like, setting up all the Krakoa magic, blah, blah.
Like, there's an apocalypse scene in this.
There's more humor, and the fact that Kitty Pryde's in the book, actually.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's kind of a cheat right there, because the thing I like most about Excalibur is that the thing
the Marauders kind of sort of in it.
Yeah, like, kind of sort of in it. And I really love Marauders, which I turned to you after I read Marauders this week and just said, okay, so officially, this is my favorite Dawn of X books.
Yeah.
Dawn of X book is Marauders. And the second issue is very different. As you pointed out, Matt, when we did Comic Rundown, because it deals with the two, it kind of reveals the second half of this story. The first issue makes you think it's all just pirate adventures and with Kitty Pryde and stuff, but this one makes you realize it's really about the Hellfire Trading Company and how it works in conjunction with the Marauders in this whole mission, and basically how they're on this kind of official, unofficial gray line of the X-Men Krakoa Nation, where, you know, what Kitty Pryde's doing is completely, like, illegal, technically on a geopolitical scale, but morally, right? And it's something Krakoa wants to do without having to officially acknowledge it. And the Hellfire Trading Company is literally basically written in to be, yo, we know in this new world we're going to have to do some shady-ish around here. We don't want to get our hands dirty. But, you know, Emma Frost and Sebastian Shaw, they love that kind of stuff. So Sebastian Shaw, we're just going to unleash him. And if you want black market drugs and stuff, we got a guy. Don't mess with that guy, because he's kind of crazy, and we're not going to stop him if he goes nuts on you.
That's so, pretty much what it is, yeah.
He's like, that's why we got him, because some people are going to need their skulls cracked. He cracks skulls, and he collects money, and that's what we're going to be doing here. And in exchange, we'll get you some drugs you might need.
I just, I just love, too, that it's crazy, because they set all that up, and then this issue is literally, like, it turning on itself prove a point. Like, don't go outside of, even though we're dealing with like black market and we're dealing with a bunch of shady stuff, there's still like a line in the sand.
Yeah. And it's like crook and there's no honor among thieves, which is like, which is kind of what this book states in this issue. This whole thing is like the ladies, Emma Frost and Kitty Pryde, basically knocking Sebastian's D down in the dirt for him because he tried to be Sebastian Shaw and, you know, step over the bounds and take more than he was supposed to and do more than he was supposed to. And so they basically heist his operation.
That's so good.
Like, Kitty pirates his operation just so the White Queen can have a drink with him and talk trash to him in conversation and basically yank his leash without, damaging her high-priced nail job and just be like, now back on the leash, dear, and don't make me come down here again. Like,
I have been so amazed by how well Jerry Duggan has written Emma Frost and Kitty Pryde.
Yeah.
Like, I did not expect it to be that good.
No.
It's been great.
Yeah, Kitty Pryde's like, If there's an all like an X-Men that we thought was kind of stale, I mean, they've tried to reinvent her like 50 different times, and this is probably my favorite reinvention besides the Age of Apocalypse, crazy Kitty Pryde. But this one is just her getting this issue, like when they find out that Xavier was assassinated, Bishop informs them, and Kitty Pryde's reaction is to keep drinking like straight from the bottle, which I love, and go right into a tattoo parlor. And get what did she get on her
hold
hands?
Fast.
Hold fast, yeah, like
on her knuckles.
Her knuckles. It's a knuckle tattoo, and that's how like imagine like Kitty Pryde from the 70s and 80s, little Kitty with her weird perm hairdo, like would have been crying Colossus or Wolverine's shoulder. This Kitty Pryde's like going to get a knuckle tattoo.
Yeah,
yeah, like screw this, I'm getting a knuckle tattoo, and I'm gonna bash this into somebody's face eventually. Like,
and I love that they run through the whole team, like as far as their takes on tattoos, and then Pyro gets an entire face tattoo.
Yeah, it's
Mike
like a
Tyson's
skull.
Face.
And he says something like completely racially derogatory. He's like, "Come on, you muties, let's do it." And you're like, "Whoa,
what are you doing, dude?"
Yeah, but that's the fun of Marauders. It's just like this is what happens, and this is what this book is, and these guys are becoming like real pirates, and it's kind of awesome to see.
So fun.
I also, like I said to you, I love that the artist commitment it takes to keep drawing Kitty Pryde with that black eye and bandage over her nose. And like, how long is this going to last? And I hope it lasts a while. Like,
yeah, it adds to the look.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, I agree.
Her being like just rough and tumble, and it's pretty great. So Marauders is so much fun. You guys should check that out. Excalibur is trying to find its way still. They're doing all this magic stuff and limbo stuff and Araco stuff.
Apocalypse is cool.
Yeah. Apocalypse is cool, man. And like I said, having like Gambit on the boat with Kitty Pryde worrying about Rogue and that whole scene and like all of that was really great. So when the Marauders are in Excalibur, it's pretty great. Other than that, we're going to just quickly touch on Absolute Carnage wrap up. Matt, I think you did a whole video about this.
Yeah.
So you guys can watch that on comicbook.com. But just to kind of touch on it, I liked Absolute Carnage might be my favorite Carnage storyline event since Maximum Carnage.
Yeah.
Or the original just three-part Carnage thing, which is obviously still my favorite. But I kind of thought it was like a weird cheat because it's not really an event as much as it's a stage-setting event that is masked as a major event. And I don't think they stuck the landing, really.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a shame because this was like one of the best in terms of crossovers, in terms of sticking in all, really nailing all the tie-ins, really just kind of being entertaining in the main series, being really entertaining in the secondary Venom series. And like I said, even the random tie-ins for Ghost Rider and everybody else, Hulk, all that stuff, Deadpool, all that stuff was really entertaining. So it's not like they botched the landing. It's just that there isn't really a landing.
Yeah. It feels like this is like issue 6 should come out next month and should be the end. Like it feels like, oh, well, we've set the table and we're done. We're going to go over here.
Yeah, and it's like really you find out that like Absolute Carnage, and we're going to talk spoilers here, okay? We're going to talk spoilers, but it just seems like Absolute Carnage is really just the stepping stone to like Universal Carnage or something
whatever,
like that. Yeah, whatever the
everything
title
everything is Carnage.
Like whatever they talk about or whatever they title the next thing, because the whole point of this was Carnage was trying to collect all these pieces and DNA samples of the symbiote that had been in various characters over Marvel, which is like everybody because Marvel went symbiote crazy. And to free the god Null, the god of the symbiotes, from this prison that's made of symbiotes, formed like about the size of a planet that he's trapped inside of. To defeat Cletus Kasady, Carnage, like, you know, Venom takes on a symbiote and kind of gains these new powers and some codex things. And he gains new powers. So they have the superpowered symbiote fight. And it ends up being that this is all a trap. Cletus Kasady is set because Venom is forced to make a choice because Carnage gets Venom's son. And it's like, either I'm going to kill your son or you kill me. But by doing that, you kind of absorb the last piece of the symbiote that you need to awaken Null. And Venom's literal take on this is F the world. I'm going to save my son. Yep. So he just forms a little symbiote sword with his hand into his hand and he just cuts down Carnage. And of course, the effect is that, Null gets woken up and kind of is riding out of this.
Those two pages?
Yeah, he's in this like little planet ball of symbiotes. He yells, kind of expunges them. They look like weird little symbiote sperms swimming through space. They all form up, and like he gets armor, a big symbiote dragon, a horde of symbiote monsters, and he's flying towards, we presume, Earth and Venom and all of that stuff. And that's the end.
Yeah.
And Venom, and the best part is, Venom, Spider-Man passes out fighting Norman Osborn Carnage during this, and so he wakes up and he's like, oh, did we win? And Venom just lies to him.
Yeah, no one knows
this has happened. Only Venom knows. Yeah, and he just lies to Spider-Man and even forms this fake bond, and he and Spider-Peter like hug it out, and they're like, Peter says like, you know, well, you know, whatever we are, like, you know, it's good to see you, and you know, it's good going forward. And he doesn't tell him anything.
Until a month from now, when we get invaded, yeah. And then you're going to tell me, oh, by the way.
Yeah, and so he doesn't say anything to him.
Yeah,
and the final scene is him sitting down with his son, Dylan, who he's been telling he's his brother. But during the fight with Carnage, he says, like, let go of my son or something. And, yeah. Like, it comes out during the fight. And so the last thing is him, and like, in a great final series
That's
of
a
panels,
great page, yeah.
It's just them sitting there, and Dylan's all, like, traumatized and shaking. Eddie's all, like, black-eyed and beat up and bleeding. Because Dylan finds out he has the power to basically destroy, because he is a living codex, basically. Like, mm-hmm. He has a strange power still finding out about. He can destroy Carnage, symbiotes.
Yeah, he just exploded. That
yeah, he awesome just, like, willfully destroys the Carnage symbiote just using, like, mental power. So, obviously, he's the key to defeating Null. So this will be the big thing. Son of Venom, you know, versus Null with Venom in the middle. But yeah, and he just says the last line is like, did you say you're my dad? And then Venom's like, oh crap. And then it just cuts. And that's the end of the whole crossover. Which is a great ending and a funny ending to that. But yeah, so I liked it. Like I said, I liked the event, but I just thought I felt I got kind of cheated by the ending.
Like a true ending.
Of a true ending. And like Carnage. And I feel like Marvel has done this thing where they've kind of burned out Cletus Cassidy as much as possible. I mean, he's literally just a corpse now.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, bones with a symbiote covering him, and now he's just gone again. It's just like, I feel like that character's just is one that just kind of gotten just, I don't know what to say, cannibalized by Marvel in some ways.
Yeah, and they'll find some way to get
and
back.
Bringing him back again when Null is just like, oh, God. Like, let's just meet Null. Let's just meet a new villain. Let's just deal with that.
Push you to the side. Yeah. That would be the good thing,
yeah.
Would be to put him on the back burner for a while.
Yeah.
Let him cool off. You've done all this work with Null. Ride that out for as long as possible.
And then go back to basics, I say.
Yeah.
Forget the symbiote god stuff, all that, and just...
I don't think they'll do
whatever that. Whatever happens with Null in the aftermath, it brings Carnage back. Just
agreed.
Plain old Carnage. All right. But that's just my take. Matt, anything else? Do you guys want to jump into WWE?
Yeah, let's jump into some wrestling.
Let's talk some wrestling. So, guys, if you don't know, we've got two shows this week, not just one. You got NXT TakeOver War Games. Yeah, I saw you. Saw you doing that. You got TakeOver War Games, then you got Survivor Series the following night on Sunday night.
Yeah.
Matt, I want to do this a little bit differently, because we always go with what's the match of the weekend.
Okay.
I'm actually going to ask you for a couple of those. But first, how do you feel they built to this? Because this is the first time we've seen NXT get inserted into the equation of the never-ending battle between Raw and SmackDown for who does Daddy love more this week.
Well,
I can tell how much I love brand supremacy.
Yeah, I know. And I don't fault you for that. But I think they've done it really well, actually. I think they turned, lemons in the lemonade, because I think once the SmackDown takeover, which was partly in the works, but also kind of helped facilitated by a traveling issue.
Big issues.
Yeah. So I think that ended up being like, you know, they had these things in plans, but I think that just was one of those things that you can't plan. And ever since then, I've been really enjoying the stuff. I mean, I know that not everyone is, but I think they've done it really well, and they saved their biggest guns kind of, you know, for this last episode of NXT. And I thought for the most part, that was the first time I'd really been looking so much forward to NXT because of the sheer, like, I don't know who's going to turn up.
Right.
And that's part of the thrill of Survivor Series. I think that's getting back into what makes that pay-per-view special. I've loved it so far.
See, I took issue with just the idea that the invasion was all they needed. Because the first time they did it, was great. It was fun. It was that episode of SmackDown. Everybody's over in Saudi Arabia. Let's get them. You know, we got to fill up 2 hours. Get Adam Cole and Daniel Bryan.
Yeah.
A freaking dream match that we'd never seen. Stuff like that. And then they just did it again. And again. And did it a few more times. To the point where I'm like, okay, so we've got this great match between AJ Styles, Roderick Strong, and Shinsuke Nakamura on Sunday. is anybody going to talk about it? Nope. Okay, why not? We got this battle of three great tag teams across the three brands going against each other. We're going to talk about that? Going to have any of them say so much as a word to the other team? Or are we just going to keep having mid-carders from the other show jump out and try to fight them and act like Mojo Rawley and Zack Ryder are legitimate threats that make Adam Cole hightail it?
Yeah.
Because we got a lot of that. Yeah. The only time they got it right was Becky. Because she actually stood face-to-face with Shayna and was like, I don't give a good gosh darn, sorry, trying to censor myself, about brand supremacy. Just like every fan in the arena is like, thank you. We don't care either.
I think, though, because I will agree with you when it comes to Raw and SmackDown. I don't agree on NXT. I thought on NXT they've had a few times where they've, one, mentioned the match that they're in, but also that the bringing AJ in and the way they built
it was good. It was used much more sparingly on NXT.
And so, but I agree with you on,
because they also had to build up their other show, which I also felt hurt the build towards War Games because they were being pulled in two different directions. It's like, I'm really mad at you because I'm going to fight you in a cage, but tomorrow we're partners.
I can definitely agree with that. I think there was some divisiveness in that, communicating like who is supposed to be against who. Like, I mean if you've watched NXT over the last couple of weeks, you still know who doesn't like who's against who. You still have a sense of the rivalries, but I agree it muddies the waters because they've had to also do this impromptu team thing. I agree.
And going forward, instead of just the blanket, okay, you're the mid-card champion, so you're going to fight the other mid-card champions. You're the women's champion, so you fight the other two women's title holders. Mm-hmm. How about actually have some rivalries?
Agreed.
Why not? Like, Shayna Becky is an easy match right there. Yeah. Bayley does not need to be in this match. I'm sorry. She really doesn't. Pam, go away. Sit in the corner.
Stop. Be nice to Bayley.
We have a better match. You can go away
for
right now.
Be nice to Bayley.
Like, I wish someone had been like, you know what, I want to go challenge AJ Styles as opposed to just, I am also champion, so I must fight champion. Like, tell a story. Don't just be like, don't throw just a whole coat of brand supremacy on this and think that counts.
I agree. And I think if we're for projecting forward, I think this is proof of concept, really, for WWE, because I think they lucked into this more than anything. I would love to see that next year. Because I imagine this ain't going anywhere.
No.
Next year, this will be back. This worked.
This is the start of...
Yes. Yeah. So if we can do that, start the run up even a little earlier if you want to get some of those stories seeded. But I agree. I want to see that fleshed out. I don't want to just see person versus person. Like Cesaro and... Shinsuke showed up.
Yeah. By the way, that happening should have been a jaw-dropping moment.
Yeah, was not at all.
And it was just, oh, it's two guys in blue shirts.
Yeah, I was more excited for Drew McIntyre popping up because
he actually looked to the crowd and was like, hey, guys, remember me?
Yeah.
I was a big deal.
So I agree. I love the Becky thing. I love some of the other stuff that they did. Ricochet showing up was actually cool because, again, it ended up in a – it wasn't an afterthought, a thrown-on thing. And
also ran into the problem of – a lot of these guys were just there. Like the Street Profits showing up at the end of Wednesday night's show.
Yeah.
I'm like, dude, you were here less than 2 months ago. Why the heck are you fighting for Raw?
I did like the Kyrie Sane little like nod.
Yeah, they acknowledged that.
You were here crazy looking.
We were friends and now you're wearing red and I'm a bad guy. Cool.
But I agree. I would like to see that next year. But I do like that. I'm excited for a back-to-back pay-per-view.
We are back to the phase of, hey, television's crap, but the pay-per-views are really good, like we were earlier this year.
There's a lot of great matches on these cards.
I think we're back to that part. So with that being said, give me three matches that you absolutely need to see this weekend.
Becky, Shayna, and Bayley.
And Pam.
Not Pam.
Her name's Pam.
Stop it.
She has the Pam hair.
Stop it. No. I'm actually, you have to say Shinsuke, AJ, and Roderick.
Roddy.
You got to say that.
So let me just point out with that one. Because people are like, oh, God, last time we had AJ Shin, it was like for 6 months and we hated all of it.
Yes.
The advantage is that there is no story this time. And the one time when they didn't have a story, it was good.
Okay. I've been burned by that couple times.
But then they were like, let's go 4 months where we just make every match about nut shots.
Yes, that's what we got last time.
And then when they stopped it, We had that Money in the Bank match, went 30 minutes. It was great.
Okay. That's why I didn't pick it as mine. My most look forward to it is Becky, but it's because I've... Because
you're a Becky fangirl.
I'm a Becky what? What did you call me?
If she's the man, you are the fangirl. Get it?
I mean, that's fine.
Damn, I mean, son!
I'm that a was fan. Actually a slip of the tongue.
That's what I thought. But either way, I mean, that's perfectly fine. I am a fan.
I'm sorry.
I am a fan, though. But I am a fan, clearly. Just as much as you are for AEW. But here's, like, for Becky and Shayna, I just think I haven't been burned by that match before. And I also think that is fresh and new. I've seen AJ and Shinsuke go at it, I don't know how many times over the last couple of years.
It's been a while.
Roddy adds a whole other thing, which I'm excited for. Mm-hmm. And then third, I would say probably the women's war game match. I'm excited for that, just the unpredictability of it. I mean, I really, I think their women's roster is fantastic. So
that's fair. I'm going with AJ, Shin, and Roddy. The tag match, because... Guys, if you haven't seen The Revival versus O'Reilly and Fish from this week's NXT, do yourself a favor. Sit down. Give yourself about 30 minutes and watch that match, because holy cow.
It's a good match.
Really good match.
It's a good match.
And now you got to imagine you put those two guys in with arguably the best tag team of this decade in the New Day and just two hosses in the Viking Raiders.
It's going to be good.
There's a lot of fun you can have.
It's going to be very good.
And the third one, I'll go with the men's War Games match, just because Keith Lee is going to shine in this match. That dude is... There is so much of that guy that reminds me of John Cena.
Really?
And I don't know if it's his charisma, if it's just the way he carries himself, if it's just that unnatural strength he can pull out of whenever. The dude just reminds me specifically of him.
Oh, I don't...
Not just being the top guy, but of Cena.
I don't necessarily see it, but I mean, that's not a bad comparison, right? I mean, it's not a bad comparison at all. I love Keith Lee, so yeah.
With all that being said, with all the insults, I'm sorry about that, by the way.
Why?
With all the arguments, I'll just say this. It's going to be a fun weekend, so check it out.
All right, that's it for WWE Survivor Series preview. I have to keep remembering like what these are called.
It's fair.
They're weird names,
you guys
dude.
Have fed so many of them into my head over the last few months.
Stomping Grounds.
Yeah, Stomping Grounds. I'm like, no holds barred. Like,
still one of the coolest logos.
That'll do it for this episode of Comic Book Nation. We want to thank you guys for tuning in. If you were just getting into the show recently, we drop new episodes every Wednesday and every Friday. This is our Friday episode. A lot of people tend to pick that one up for the weekend, but make sure you also hit up our Wednesday episode. It's when we always get in the middle of the crazy news week. Things are being coming at us fast and furious. Janelle Wheeler's here. It's a good time, so make sure you check out that episode as well. If you want to subscribe and get regular updates on the show, you can go through our post on comicbook.com where we have an RSS feed, or you can subscribe on iTunes. You can subscribe on iHeartRadio, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Google Playlists. You can tell any Amazon Alexa device to fire up Comic Book Nation podcast, or you can catch us on YouTube under the comicbook.com page. If you want to continue discussion about everything we talked about, you can hit us up at the hashtag Comic Book Nation, or you can find me at Kofi Outlaw.
You can find me at Matt Aguilar CB.
At Connor Casey underscore CB.
And if you like the show, be sure to go on iTunes, drop a 5-star review. I know we say we're going to do it.
Oh, yeah.
We don't have time today. We have too much to do, but we will be doing it next week. I'll make that promise to myself right now. We're going to be reading more 5-star reviews. So last weekend, because we're going to give thanks, you know, for all of you guys tuning in. So be sure to leave your 5-star reviews on iTunes so we can do that. That'll do it for us for this episode, but we'll be sure to see you next time for episode 86. This is Comic Book Nation, and we're out of here. Peace.
Deuces.
Later.